This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 5th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 280. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. The Is It Just Me commentary. And the big deal feature. Special guest Terry Glavin, the National Post columnist and the Real Story Substack newsletter publisher. Justin Trudeau is under Xi Jinping's thumb. China's magic weapon hits Canadian targets. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or should the Nordstrom store in downtown Vancouver be replaced by clean and safe housing to get all of Vancouver's homeless off the streets, plus a recovery clinic to get addicts off drugs? The upscale Seattle department store chain announced last week that it was pulling out of Canada. It'll close all 13 stores and lay off 2,500 people by June. Department stores were big in the 20th century, but not anymore. It's even worse after the pandemic. The Pacific Center flagship is 230,000 square feet over three floors, designed coincidentally by a firm called Omicron. Memo to Mayor Ken Sim, Premier David Eby, and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Downtown Vancouver does not need any more offices or luxury condos. Lease or buy the Nordstrom space, transform it into a place to give the poorest, weakest in society a chance to turn their lives around so that they can contribute to society. This could be a game changer. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. It is still early in 2023, but the biggest political scandal in Ottawa is the revelation that the People's Republic of China interfered in the 2021 federal election. The Globe and Mail's coverage of a leaked report by Canada's spy agency revealed how the Consul General in Vancouver, Tong Chao-Ling, boasted that she played a role in replacing incumbent Richmond Conservatives Kenny Chiu and Alice Wong with rookie Liberals Parm Baines and Wilson Miao. Global News reported on Chinese Communist Party infiltration of Don Valley North Liberal MP Han Dong's campaign. On March 2nd, a House of Commons committee voted 6-5 in favor of a public inquiry. The Liberal members voted against. So what's next? Joining me from Vancouver Island is Terry Glavin, the columnist with the National Post and publisher of the Substack newsletter called The Real Story. I started by asking Terry Glavin if Canada had finally reached the tipping point in its relationship with communist China.
Well, I think we reached that point about two and a half years ago when, I mean, it was, you know, it was longer ago than that, but it's kind of reassuring in a way that I always, when I worry if I'm just sort of banging on about this a little too much, you know, every once in a while there'll be another Angus Reid poll and it'll show, you know, I'm normal. I mean, I have no heterodox views about China at all. 87% of Canadians agree with me. And it wasn't always like that, you know, like I can remember, because I've been covering this for a long time. This goes back, I was thinking the other day, I think 14 years. And it was when the Chinese state-owned enterprises were buying up strategic spigot points in the oil patch during the Harper years. And the Obama administration was gently warning us that, you know, you can't be throwing in your lot with Sinopec and people who are, you know, violating UN sanctions in Iran and Syria, and Anthony Campbell, who was the former, he just resigned as the head of the Intelligence Secretariat for the Privy Council Office. The words he used to me were, "We're sitting ducks." And, you know, Harper kind of went in like a lion and out like a lamb on China. You know, he actually was principled and he took some pretty hard lines on China, but he kept getting beat up by the business press and finally decided there's really no percentage in it and sort of started playing along like he was Kretchen or something. But he did put his foot down the tiniest bit. And, you know, have we reached a tipping point? I think we, in some ways, have. I think we've certainly reached the point of no return. There's no way, absolutely no way, that the Trudeau government can continue to pretend that, you know, like as they said during the kidnapping of the two Michaels, well, you know, these are consular issues and we have consular problems with governments all the time. You know, the complaint you would hear from people like Dominic Barton, who was our ambassador to China, guy's Mephistopheles, he's not a very nice person, is that, you know, his big complaint was that the kind of the program was being screwed up. You know, China was making it really difficult for its friends in Canada to, you know, do the work. And I think that the Americans have boxed Trudeau's ears, and they have been for a while, but after Joe Biden's election, we could no longer pretend that, you know, this concern with China was just Donald Trump being a dork. Donald Trump didn't do anything useful on China at all that wasn't a function and product of bilateral or bipartisan agreement in Congress. He was disinclined, actually, to do anything useful on China. And so Biden comes in and Canadians are like, oh gosh, you know, he's a real hard line. He's a hawk. And that's actually not the case. The man is not particularly militant, not particularly principled, but he recognizes that the world has cleaved in twain, that you've got Russia, Iran, Belarus, Venezuela, China on one side, and you've got Europe and the United States and North America on the other side. And so this is the thing, you know, that I don't know. It's a funny thing how impermeable the Trudeau government is to Canadian public opinion, particularly on this subject. He went all in on China a long, long time ago. It's a family thing with him. I mean, he says that himself. He, you know, you had Harper wanted Canada to be the world's energy superpower. Trudeau comes along and he wants Canada to be this post-national state that's integrated its economy with the Chinese economy. And I, you know, a lot of people say, oh gosh, you must be really naive. There's probably naivete involved in it to some extent because he's so pathologically susceptible to flattery. You know, he was the subject of a united front, essentially a seduction campaign going back to 2013, I think it was, 2013, 2014. And that whole contribution to the McGill University, you know, the statue of his dad, you know, the contributions to the Trudeau Foundation, all of that, CSIS has now made known, was a very elaborate United Front influence operation. And it worked. And so, you know, I think the interesting thing about the latest revelations about the interference in the 2019 and 2021 elections, we saw this going on. We reported it. The Atlantic Council's forensic lab reported it. You were reporting on it in the difficulties that Kenny Chu was having in Richmond. I think what's really
what's the thing to keep your eye on is that the Chinese, you know, for one thing, election interference is new to them. There was a Financial Times or Financial Post article. These reporters got a hold of a United Front training manual back in 2017 that showed that the United Front was boasting about having manipulated elections in the GTA in 2003 and 2006. But after Trudeau was elected, it was like, why bother? You know, we're on Easy Street. We control the Canadian Senate. This is the thing that, you know, I'm glad to see that people are paying attention to at least one institution of Canadian politics that they've been monkeying with. They have mobbed up the Canadian Senate. And they did so shortly after Trudeau was elected, and Trudeau allowed it to happen, was happy to have it happen. And I think the situation now, you know, well, the situation in 29 and particularly 2021 was that they genuinely were worried about Trudeau losing the election. And particularly in 2021, they could not abide the idea of Erin O'Toole's Conservative Party taking over. Erin O'Toole's Conservatives had an incredibly robust China policy. It was a page and a half of their platform. Everything that the Hong Kongers asked for was there. Everything that the, you know, Amnesty International asked for was there. Everything that the Uyghurs asked for was there. A very sophisticated position on acquisitions by state-owned enterprises. It was all there. And it was just untenable. I mean, you know, for all these years, China had their guy in the prime minister's office. And suddenly the Conservatives come along and say, you know, we're your worst nightmare. And so they started to pull out all the stops. And I think that's the story here. The other story is that, there's a couple of other stories, but the other big story is that, you know, CSIS really has roots the level of its tolerance. You know, Vigneault is a very polished character, says all the right things at committee meetings, but, you know, the guys who have been running the China file have had it. They've had it. I mean, what do you do, Bob? Like, if you're assigned to, you know, conduct surveillance on the United Front and its strong arm operations in the Mandarin Block, in the GTA and Metro Vancouver, and you know, you find that you look at the Liberal Party's activist base in the so-called Chinese community is actually embedded in the same hierarchy, Mandarin Bloc hierarchy, that is the base of the United Front in Canada. They're the same people. So, you know, what are you gonna do if you're a CSIS agent? You're gonna start, you know, spying on cabinet ministers, open a file on the prime minister? It's that bad. It's that bad. They're the same people. And I think that's the thing that's freaked out Trudeau so much about these election leaks. Not the RCMP, not CSIS, not the Critical Election Incident Protocol Panel, not the site team. None of those agencies has actually denied anything that has been reported in the Globe and Mail. Steve Chase, Bob Fyfe, Sam Cooper, none of them have. And even Trudeau, you know, when you look at his responses, you know, he will resent the insinuation that yada yada, or he will strenuously object to anti-Asian racism, all this sort of thing. or in one case said there's so many inaccuracies that we don't know where to begin. But they, even Trudeau has not managed to say this is inaccurate. This is wrong. It did not happen. I did not say that. What he will do is he will, you know, what is it? It's a bait and switch thing where he'll say, you know, I did not say this. And this is something that actually nobody reported he said. So he's clearly hiding something, right? And what he's hiding is that the Liberal Party in the Chinese communities and the United Front hierarchy in the Mandarin bloc is the same thing. It's one and the same.
On March 3rd, Foreign Minister Melanie Joly tweeted that she met with her China counterpart, Shen Gang, at the G20 summit and told him that Canada would not tolerate foreign meddling in its elections. In The Real Story, my guest Terry Glavin explained the history of the United Front, one of the three magic weapons of the Chinese Communist Party. CSIS Director David Vigneault told the House Committee on March 2nd that China spends more on United Front activities than it does on regular overt diplomacy.
There's one aspect in Canada that we've seen develop over the years, the Canada-China Business Council. How does the Canada-China Business Council play into the CCP strategy, especially United Front?
It's the same program. It's, I think it's helpful for people who might not be too familiar with this to understand the Trudeau Liberal Party. 70% of all the Liberal Party members that carried Trudeau on their shoulders into the Prime Minister's office in 2015, 70% were recruited by Justin Trudeau. So it's kind of a coalition between these hipsters and the old Montreal Power Corporation, SNC-Lavalin, Desmarais family, Canada-China Business Council crew. And, you know, we have to remember that Trudeau was very explicit about this. People didn't bother him about it. You didn't ask him about it. It's always some weird kind of thing that Trudeau talks about. But he was very explicit that he wanted to, you know, make Canada into a post-national state, free movement of capital and labor, no distinction between, you know, fellow democracies and police states, China, 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 China. One thing I did this morning when I was doing an interview with some Americans on this is a kind of a thought experiment. Try to imagine if Donald Trump gets elected 2016, hires the head of the Russian American Business Council to pick his cabinet, sees to it that the head of the Russian American Business Council gets the top job in the Senate, flies off to Moscow, let's talk about a free trade agreement, let's talk about an extradition treaty. Hires a seedy, corrupt, global deal maker who's on a first name basis with all of Vladimir Putin's oligarchs and says, okay, your job, and we are going to embed you and your consulting firm in at the top of the finance ministry, and you are going to devise Canada's economic development strategy, trade, immigration, everything. That's what Justin Trudeau did. He appointed Peter Harder from the Canada-China Business Council to pick his cabinet, run his transition, gave Peter Harder the top job in the Senate, flitted off to China, you know, let's have an extradition treaty, let's have a free trade agreement, hired Dominic Barton from McKinsey to run the show, the blue chip, you know, economic growth panel. You know, if you worked for that panel, even so much if you were just answering the phones, your check came from McKinsey. It didn't come from the Treasury. So you know, that's a hell of a thing to do. That's pretty radical. That's pretty crazy. And, you know, it was just, and, you know, taking Li Keqiang, you know, to Montreal and putting a Montreal Canadiens jersey on him and sliding him out on the ice and inviting him up to Harrington Lake, sitting around with the missus, having drinks with the kids in an Adirondack chair. I mean, please. It was in front of our noses. And that's the interesting thing about, you know, about sedition laws, about subversion law, is that the presumption is always that it will be clandestine. Because the presumption is always, well, you wouldn't do that out in the open, obviously. So there's actually a legal presumption in our law that it will be subterranean. But if it's out in the open, if it's in plain sight, there's nothing illegal about it. So, you know, and it becomes so normalized that, you know, before the 2021 election, John McCallum, who, you know, actually took China's side during the Menghuangzhou affair, had to be, you know, Chrystia Freeland said either he goes or I go. You know, went back into the business of palm greasing in China and said on the record to a South China Morning Post reporter, I am advising my former interlocutors at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in how the Chinese government should conduct itself in such a way as to more readily assure the re-election of the Liberal Party and the defeat of the Conservatives. Set that on the record, inviting foreign interference in Canada's election. Our former ambassador, a Liberal cabinet minister. So, you know, I still don't think the penny is quite dropped. I still don't think most people realize just how sinister this has been. I don't know why. I mean, maybe it's because Justin Trudeau has nicer hair than Donald Trump. But there you go. That's where we are now. And I think he may actually survive this. I think he may actually survive this. If you look at what the House Special Committee on the House Affairs and Procedures this week, the motion that was adopted, that motion basically deals with everything but China. The purpose of that whole thing was to change the subject and bury the story. And, you know, Peter Julian from the NDP has done a very good job of that. The original motion didn't even mention China. He wanted to talk about Brexit and anti-vaxxers and the Freedom Convoy and the Russian psyops in the States. They do not want people to know about this. This happened. And they knew it was happening, and they knew when it was happening, and they don't want us to know what happened. That's a pretty big deal. Pretty big deal.
Now, China's rubber stamp parliament is meeting in Beijing. Xi Jinping is starting his third term. What next for the world when it comes to dealing with China? What next for Canada?
Yeah, it's when you look at the state of the world, it's pretty grim. And you know, the changes come upon us very quickly, and I don't think a lot of the sort of the ruling elites in the West have the moral or intellectual capacity to sort of confront what we're dealing with here. It is a complete collapse of the world order. And we still talk like, you know, the kind of the line out of Ottawa on China, you know, you can sum up in a paragraph, you know, mumbo jumbo about competition and Canadian values, mumbo jumbo. But we have to cooperate on issues like climate change. What has that done for us, cooperating with them on climate change. They just don't open 25 more coal mines. You know, you look at the amount of greenhouse gases that have been pumped up into the upper stratosphere by China in the last, I guess it's 20 years, is equal to the amount of greenhouse gases pumped up into the upper stratosphere by Great Britain since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. So I don't know. It doesn't look good. I think in some respects, you know, the thing about dictatorships of one variety or another is that they're very, very brittle. And you never know. This is the thing I noticed about the Arab Spring, about the uprising in Iran, the occasional uprisings in China, is an old adage. You never know the lash to the back of the slave that will cause him to rise against his master. You never know the hour of the night. And not knowing what happens next is something that actually gives me some hope. I haven't the faintest idea. And that kind of cheers me up, because things could get worse, and they will. Things could get better, and they probably will in some respects. The other thing about these guys is that they will burn the country rather than give up power, you know. That's what we saw in Syria. I don't think collectively the liberal democracies will ever be forgiven for what was allowed to transpire in Syria. I'd still have nightmares for that. And what Russia did to Syria, what Russia did to Aleppo, what Russia did to Grozny, what Russia did to, Chechnya, South Ossetia, he's doing to Ukraine. And they won't be stopped, unless they're stopped. And Xi Jinping is Vladimir Putin's guarantor and financier. And I think we really have to recognize these guys for what they are. And there's very little we can do, in terms of achieving regime change. But I do think we need to develop a different kind of ethos in the West. We have to hunker down a bit, and we have to think more about taking care of one another and feeding one another and clothing and housing ourselves, and get back to some of the priorities and the basics. The old economic models are just, you read about how, world rating agencies putting Vancouver up there as, one of the most livable cities in the world. When it's a bolt hole for real estate investments for millionaires and gazillionaires from torture states all over the world, primarily China. And you've got thousands of people sleeping in the streets. So, I wish I could be a bit more cheery about what to expect next. But I do have faith in ordinary people. I have faith in Canadians. I think most Canadians are pretty straightforward.
I also want to end on a bit of a personal note, to point people to another publication, Globe and Mail, an obituary worth reading. Your family recently suffered the loss of your mother. The headline, Bletchley girl Eileen Glavin scanned airwaves for German messages during wartime. It's a fascinating read. She looked to be 101 and a half, as the obituary says, and she had a wicked Irish sense of humor all the way. A very good read and a life well lived.
Yeah, she was a bit of a celebrity, and it's been a really astonishing, ever since she passed. I haven't grieved really, and I don't know. People will say, "Oh, it'll catch up to you," but what can I say? I mean, all I can think is that I'm just so incredibly blessed, so fortunate to have been. I mean, I won the lottery just being her son, for God's sake. We came up hard, working class people. But, you know, what a ma. And, you know, my mother, the spy. I mean, it's sort of great stories that you can tell, right? Like, she couldn't tell us about what she was doing for 25 years after because of the Official Secrets Act in Britain. And, you know, I guess it was after the book and the movie came out about Alan Turing and the Enigma Project that people started to discover Mom and really made a fuss of her. But yeah, she lived for 101 and a half years. She raised four cantankerous Irish Catholic working class boys. And then she raised her eight Jewish children, as she puts them, the Fierstein kids. Aviva, Panina, Yosef, Elishava, Shifra, David, Nachama. I think I've got them all. If I forgot one, I'd feel bad. Mm-hmm. you know, a devout Irish Catholic woman, and you know, kind of being kind of an expert in kosher law, and very happy. I mean, that was the thing about Ma, was that she was just bloody happy, you know, and tended to be quite infectiously happy. And so, yeah, it's been. The last month has been quite emotionally exhausting, but in a good way, in a good way.
That was my guest, Terry Glavin, National Post columnist and publisher of the Real Story Substack newsletter. Just Google Terry Glavin and Substack. I subscribe, and so should you. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, President Tsai hails Taiwan's being ranked fourth freest economy. Taiwan, second only to Singapore in Index of Economic Freedoms Asia Pacific ranking. The 29th edition of the annual index, compiled by the Heritage Foundation, a U.S. think tank, ranked Singapore, Switzerland, and Ireland in the world top three. China was 154th. In Kyoto news, sushi chain installs AI camera system after licking scandal. The industry was shaken by a series of incidents involving customers licking soy sauce bottles and conducting other unhygienic acts. Kura Sushi, which already had cameras installed at its restaurants for counting customers' plates, has modified its system so that it can identify suspicious behavior, such as returning a plate to the conveyor belt. In the Hong Kong Free Press, I can finally breathe. Some celebrate the end of Hong Kong's COVID mask rule, but most remain cautious. Hong Kong's COVID-19 mask mandate, in place for almost 1,000 days, was officially scrapped last Wednesday. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Coin TV, grieving families pushed Taylor's Law to put dealers in prison for 5 years. Taylor Martinek died at age 24 after unknowingly buying counterfeit oxycodone and Xanax containing fentanyl from a local drug dealer. His family was at the legislature in 2019 when Taylor's Law was introduced as a bill and had a hearing, but the measure never made it onto the governor's desk. But time is ticking. Bills have to have a work session scheduled by March 17th, meaning a hearing and a decision to move a bill to the floor for a vote. In King 5, vaping marijuana becoming more prevalent than nicotine in schools. School administrators are beginning to see negative impacts on student health. Of the 18 vaping devices Principal Aaron Duez has confiscated this school year at Anacortes High School, 16 of them are for pot. Quote, "We're seeing a rise in students vaping THC where we used to just see nicotine," she said. The situation has grown so serious that ambulances had to be called for two students. Others have ended up nauseous and vomiting. One student was actually referred to inpatient treatment for addiction to THC. In the Times Colonist, climate activist smears paint on museum's iconic woolly mammoth. A video online shows a woman sitting in front of the woolly mammoth at the Royal BC Museum, the tusks of which appear to have pink paint on them. Three people were arrested and taken to Victoria Police cells. In November, two people calling for an end to the Coastal GasLink pipeline project threw maple syrup at a 1934 Emily Carr painting at the Vancouver Art Gallery before gluing themselves to the wall next to the painting.
That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
search and rescue volunteers who have died in the line of duty. March 2nd was the Search and Rescue Volunteers Memorial Day in BC.
You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 5th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 5th of March in 1946, Winston Churchill coined the phrase Iron Curtain during a speech in Missouri? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's patreon.com/TheBreakerNews.
Until next week.